Greetings from Prashanthi Nilayam. I am Venkat Raman, and once again I am barging in on Thursday Live, but at the invitation of the host. Let me say, I didn't do any arm twisting. I am glad I am was asked to say a few words today. And by the way, before I begin, let me say I thank very much all the mails I received commenting on my earlier talk about the futility of war. This time there is going to be a big change of subject, and that is because soon it would be the season of Navaratri. That is when the Divine Mother would be worshipped all over this country and in different ways too. Slipped into these festivities would be the Saraswati Puja and the Ayudha Puja, two important inserts. In the midst of all this revelry and celebrations, few pause to ask, why do we do all this? What have the Ayudha Puja and stuff like that got to do with Mother? These are some of the points I wish to briefly touch upon in this slot which I have been invited to occupy today. Excuse me. Let me begin by drawing your attention to the fact that people of almost all countries refer to the country as their motherland. Germany, of course, is a famous exception, and Germans refer to their country as their fatherland. Now, leaving that aside, nature has been worshipped as mother for a long time, especially by the pagans. They openly revered nature as their mother, and so did tribes in all parts of the world, from Australia and New Zealand to United States and Canada, where the native Indians revered nature. So let's now ask a simple question. Why do so many think of nature as a mother higher than the bodily mother we all have? Is not the bodily mother enough? Why do we have to worship a higher mother? And who is this higher mother, by the way? But the answer to all this is fairly simple. Just as the physical mother always cares for her children and tries to provide them with everything they need, nature, if I may call her mother, Mother Nature too provides us with so many, many things, far more than we care to remember. In fact, we don't even bother to spend a minute remembering those things. And what is worse, we seldom find even a minute to express gratitude for the innumerable blessings and bounties we receive. That is quite against our tradition in India. In the Indian tradition, the festival of Navaratri is set apart mainly for the adoration of the Divine Mother in all her various aspects. Now, before I say more about Navaratri, let me first say a few words about why ancient Indians had so many festivals. And this is particularly interesting because the Upanishads, which epitomized the highest aspects of Indian spirituality, emphatically stressed that God is one, He is eternal, He is changeless, formless, nameless, etc., etc. Furthermore, God in His ultimate aspect is ethereal and transcends creation, is beyond creation. And immanent in this God are supreme qualities like satya or truth, dharma or righteousness, shanti or supreme inner peace and so on, not forgetting tyaga or sacrifice and kshama or forbearance. All this is fine, but the ancestors of ours knew that ordinary folks would not understand all this. Ordinary folks live in the universe which is surrounding us, which is full of mountains, rivers, sea, land, trees, animals, snakes, and so on. They can relate to that, but not to some God who is beyond the mind. So what did they do? They told the people, listen, God is not so far away, because God is the one who created this universe, and He got Himself embedded into it completely. How did this happen? That also was explained by the ancients. They said, God in His supremest and ultimate form, He doesn't have a name, but let us give Him the name Akshara Brahman, intangible Brahman, God. Now from this intangible God, who is beyond space and time, that peeled off a replica of him, was known as the Charabrahman. And Charabrahman had the ability to occupy space and time, create things, and become embedded in them. Thus, in this creation, where there are inert and living forms, Brahman becomes immanent in every single entity from the atom to the cosmos, and in every single living creature from the ant to the elephant. Some would undoubtedly recall Swami saying in his discourses, this microphone is God, this tumbler is God, this table is God, and so on. Now at this point you might wonder, how did this creation come about? Science has a detailed model, but does Vedanta have any? Actually Vedanta does have many models, which more or less agree in the main, but differ in the details. This is not the time to go into all those details. This is not the time to go into all those details. But just recall that earlier I said that from Akshara Brahman, Kshara Brahman peeled off to bring about creation. Some of you may recall Swami saying, I separated myself from myself in order to love myself. The separation that Swami refers to is the same as the peeling off aspect which I mentioned earlier. By the way, in the Gita, Krishna uses the name Purushottama for Akshara Brahman and Purusha for the Chara Brahman. That is in passing. Now this Purusha is also known by other names, as we shall soon see. And basically Purusha is a mixture of consciousness and energy. These are intangible aspects of Purusha. Consciousness on the one hand and energy on the other. They both have to come together to play complementary roles in order to create all sorts of diversity. Now this Purusha and energy, they form a pair and they are given many names like Purusha and Prakriti, Shiva and Shakti, and so on. Since life as we know it is the result of the coming together of the male and female, it is customary to associate Purusha with the male aspect of creation and Prakriti with the female aspect of creation. Really, there is no male and female. They are two forces which are intangible. But for our understanding, we give them these identities. Now, in creation, consciousness or Purusha remains unchanged. But Prakriti or energy splits into two parts. One part that is needed for creating inanimate entities and another part that is needed for creating living entities. In short, the basic building blocks for emergence of diversity in creation are A, Purusha or consciousness, and B, Prakriti in a dual aspect as insentient energy and sentient energy. It is via various combinations of these two that we get diverse types of inert matter and living matter. Let me now focus on us humans, because we not only dominate planet Earth, but are currently engaged in ruining it at a furious pace. In the Gita, Krishna says the following, I am in you at three levels. At the level of the gross, I am your body. More specifically, my energy is in every single atom of your body. This inert energy is what is quantified by Einstein's famous formula, E equals mc square. And this energy, by the way, remains even after you die, because the atoms don't go away after you die. They are still there. Next, says Krishna, I am in you as my subtle aspect, as the life energy or prana shakti. As long as the prana shakti is in your body, you are alive. The moment it leaves you, you are dead. So what does this prana shakti do? Well, it is the sort of fuel that keeps the engine of the body moving. And more than anything else, it powers your mind. Being subtle, this prana shakti cannot be touched, it cannot be burnt, it cannot be smelt, it cannot be torn, nothing can happen to it. You might have heard Krishna say all this about the Atma. The same is true of prana shakti. And then, at a still higher level, that goes beyond the gross and subtle, I reside in your heart as a representative of the Charabrahman or Purusha. That is what we usually refer to as the Atman. Remember, Swami often told us, I am in you. What he meant was that the Akshara Brahman was immanent in the heart of every single human being. Akshara Brahman, who is beyond, that is the timeless aspect is within you, though you are bound by space and time. Now, we call the God within as Atman and we call the God without as Brahman. Does it make sense to have two gods? Absolutely not. It's just two names given to one God and we get confused about these two aspects. It may interest you to know that in 1944, the famous physicist and winner of the Nobel Prize, Erwin Schrödinger, delivered four seminal lectures in Ireland on the topic, What is Life? This book is available. It's published by the Cambridge University. And it's a book I strongly recommend you to read. And in this book, Schrödinger actually wrote down the equation Atman equals Brahman. And that means he, as a scientist, was able to recognize that everything is Brahman or Atman, including our body, our mind, and what we call our soul. Now, I can go on and on, but let me come to this point. And I'll make it a baker's dozen, 13 points. First, as Swami often told us, everything in creation and beyond is God. Everything in creation is God, whom we call Charabrahman, and the one beyond it we call Aksharabrahman. That is the source. Within creation, God assumes all forms. He can be a snake, a tiger, a butterfly, a moth, a man, woman, anything, mountain, elephant, you name it. God is within that. At all levels, God is within there as the gross body, as the prana shakti, and whatever brain there is in that creature. By design, he makes the bodily parents closest to us. So we say mother, father, but actually that is God. Mother is a representative of God doing God's work. Father is a representative of God doing God's work. And so is the Guru. And these facts have been dealt into us by other Vedas. What about the rest of the entities in creation? Is mountain a God? Is river a God? Is snake a God? Is bull a God? When we ask questions like that, people laugh. Are you mad? Except there may be a God. I accept your mother may be revered as a God. So with father and guru. There it stops. You can't go and call everybody a god, can you? And that is where there is a massive failing. And the failing is most prominent where the earth is concerned. Nature as a whole and earth is a part of nature. That is very important to us because we live on planet earth. And here there is a massive failing. If only we realize that earth is our god, is a god, so a larger mother, would we harm earth? Would we harm the ecosystem that surrounds planet earth and literally gives life to it? Who gave us, let me put it this way, who gave us air? It was God. This air is covering the earth. It is not covering any other planet in the solar system. We know that for sure. This earth has got water. Maybe there is water in one of the moons of Jupiter, but what good does that do to us? You and I are able to drink water because there is water on this earth. And if there was no land, we would have all drowned long ago. Maybe we would be living as fish, but I don't know about that. Without even spending 1 second to think about this, we are destroying, polluting air, water and land, and destroying the entire ecosystem recklessly. Now, is this the way one would treat one's mother? At least not in earlier times. These days people forget even their bodily mother. But now we are forgetting the higher mother, which is earth. People say, oh no, it's not possible to avoid pollution because we need growth. What nonsense. Growth. What is the meaning of this growth if 80% of the people on earth become sick? Now you may say, come on, that's not going to happen. Please go and read the news, current news about what is happening in Beijing. There are so many coal-burning factories around Beijing. The place has become unlivable. The carbon pollution is very high. And the people say we don't want growth. But the government says we need growth, we have to export. And people are becoming sick, children are developing asthma. And they are just not able to control the coal pollution. It's becoming alarming and dangerous. So what is the need of growth if everybody dies? Who is there to enjoy the growth? I don't understand. We used to worship knowledge as goddess Saraswati. Today what are we doing? Knowledge is sold as a commodity. And only those with money can buy it. We used to worship wealth as goddess Lakshmi. Today we insult her by using money for all sorts of undesirable purposes. Our physical mother gives us life and brings us into the world. And here in this world, God is in innumerable ways, God in innumerable ways plays the role of our larger mother, even when we are separated from our physical mother. A man may be in America, his mother may be in Madras. But even in America, he needs the Mother Earth. That is, how can we live? It is Mother Earth that gives food, it's Mother Earth that gives him air to breathe, water to drink, and a land in which he can have a house. So to sum up, many celebrations are held during this special period that are set apart for the adoration of Divine Mother in all her forms, as art, culture, knowledge, work, and so on. Let us wholeheartedly participate in all these functions. Let us also try to know the significance of these functions. But while doing so, let us also spend some time reflecting on how much we owe to so many and for years and years. Let us also appreciate that instead of expressing gratitude, we now glibly dare even to bite the hand that feeds. Mother Nature is most compassionate and can be incredibly patient. She might seem to suffer in silence, but let me tell you, when she is aroused, which happens only when she is severely provoked, she can be unbelievably furious. The typhoons, massive earthquakes, extended spells of drought and mountain tsunamis that we now begin to see with increasing frequency are signs of that. The bottom line is that at least this Navaratri, let us go beyond mere rituals and symbolism to realize that Mother surrounds us all round till the end of space and time, and that we live by her grace alone. It is not obvious that we are realizing that the one whom we call Mother is none other than God. It is God who we revere as Mother. Is that not the why many intuitively address Swami as Sai Ma? Though he called himself Avatar, people chose to see Mother, because Swami was embodiment of compassion, kindness, kshama, etc., etc. Think about it.
Thank you very much, Professor Venkatraman, for coming to the studio and sharing your thoughts, something to think about as we prepare ourselves to celebrate Navaratri. And as you very rightly mentioned, many times we get lost in the rituals and all the other aspects of the celebration, doing the yajnas, and you know, somebody takes up Devi Mahatmyam reading, somebody else takes up some other Parayanam. So everybody tries to do all that diligently. But I think somewhere we forget to see the larger picture of revering nature as Mother. And I think that is a very, very beautiful perspective and very, very profound aspect. How Bhagwan always mentioned that spirituality should not be boxed to our rituals and a few things that we do. It should not be a cloak that we put on when we go to a temple, but we should look at it in its larger perspective. And since you are mentioning about pollution and development, I just reminded of what I read recently about what is happening to Indian rivers. They say that almost half of India's 445 rivers are unfit for drinking now. And it's because of raw sewage and industrial waste. And that is a major concern now, because 38 billion liters of municipal wastewater generated every day in India, and of that only 29% is treated.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
I don't believe it.
So, I mean, and if you look at India, it's home to 18% of world population, but it has only 2.4% of the land area of the world. And so there is so much of tremendous stress on its land, on its water, on its air. And so many times when people think that we have to have a higher standard of life, as you have many times mentioned, we cannot afford to have that kind of a resource and energy intensive growth and style that the other countries have. So what I would ask is, if you can just dwell a little more on how we should go about it. On one, you did refer to it that yes, growth, nobody says growth is not needed, but growth many times comes at the cost of taking away something from the environment. So how do we balance this growth as well as not tampering much with the environment?
This is a good question, and it basically boils down to establishing priorities. Now, one of the reasons there is a craze for growth, so-called, is material growth, by the way.
Yes.
Because the world has become highly interconnected. Now, when I say growth must be given due importance, what I mean is, nobody should deny the basic necessities of human people. You can't live without a shelter. Even caveman needed a shelter. He used to go to find a cave or something like that. That's why he was called caveman.
Yes.
You need drinking water, you need food. So, this is the famous Roti Kapda Makan.
Yes.
But something more is needed. You needed knowledge, you need education, you need a system. You cannot live individually. You need a system where labor is shared, responsibility is shared, and everything from pleasure to pain is shared. That was there in the community. There were bonds of kinship, and there were slightly higher bonds related to worship. People came together on festival days, whether it's Vinayak Chaturthi or Durga Ashtami. In Calcutta, that's a very big celebration.
Absolutely.
So on.
It's an industry.
It's an industry now. What is not an industry? So, especially in the Alps region, there were valleys, very high mountains and valleys on the other side. So every time you wanted to go to a valley on the other side, you had to climb a big mountain, and which was very tiresome, especially in winter. So these people became so segregated, each village had its own dialect. I mean, Switzerland, they speak three languages, German, French and Italian, depending on whether you are north, west or south. But if you go to the German part, and Austria particularly, Austria is fully German, but the dialect will vary from village to village, because they were out of communication for long periods.
Yes.
Once in 3 years they will meet each other.
Same with India also. You go, I think, 100 kilometers,
that is true.
You'll find it different.
In dialect. UP there are so many dialects.
Absolutely.
So, but they started vanishing and fused into one language or one dialect, massive dialect, which has now been taken over by the film industry. What is the film language is the universal language. Other than that, as somebody said on BBC, he was asked, what is India's language? He said, cricket. Now, in those days when communication was not there, this idea of, and material wealth was not there. You know, you didn't have Rolls Royce, you didn't have so many things to choose from. That was what you call modest aspirations, and rest of the time available was by tradition spent in things that were beneficial to us, although not all did benefit. But today, there was a time until the 70s when growth was not so maniacal. That was when they said we will stop producing cars and trucks and things like that in order to sell and make money. Let us make money out of thin air. as Warren Buffett put it. So they had this thing called financial industry. Before that, there was no financial industry. There was automobile industry, film industry, and so on. Now they had the financial industry. What they do is they use money to make money. And if I may, I'll tell you a short story to illustrate what is this financial industry. This is about a small town in America, farming town, very small town. There was a fellow, let's say Joe. He said, he put a small ad, I've got a donkey, I'm ready to sell it for $20. Any bidders? So, two or three fellows came to look at the donkey. He said, no, it's not okay for me, I need something else. To pull carts and all that in the farm. And one fellow came, let's say his name is Tom. Tom said to Joe, hey, I'll buy this donkey. What price? $25. $20. Okay, $20. And then now I'm going to city on work. I'll come back 2 days later. I'll then take the donkey to my house. He said, no problem. It's your donkey. 2 days later, he comes. Tom comes. Hey, Joe, give me my donkey. Joe says, Tom, I got bad news for you. What do you mean? He said, your donkey is dead. Oh. Then give my money back. He said, no, it's your donkey. I asked you to take it. There's a big fight. Then finally he said, all right, give me the donkey. He said, what are you going to do with the donkey? Well, it's none of your problem. So he takes the donkey. And then he goes to a small neighboring village or town and he puts an advertisement. There is a lottery. Donkeys cost $20. You buy a $2 ticket, you win, you get the donkey. Mm-hmm. So 500 people give money, $2 each. He gets $1,000. Then he makes a glass bowl, writes the name of all the people one by one, folds it, and calls the kid, hey kid, you pull out one. He shakes it down. Kid pulls out. This is Smith. Mr. Smith, congratulations. You win the donkey for $2. Gentlemen, that's over. You can all go home. So he takes this guy and he shows him the donkey. That's your donkey. He goes, what do you mean by this cheating? Give me my money back. All right, here's your $2. So donkey is dead. He gets back his $2 and he has got the money he spent on the nearly $1,000, $2 gone, $998, and from that subtract the some other money which he had to get. No, that's all he had to subtract.
Yes.
So this man made money. And the story says, a week later, Joe was in Wall Street working for Lehman Brothers or something like that. So what I'm trying to say is
out of thin air.
Money out of thin air. And at some point, you even drop the facade of all these trading companies, what is called investment banker and all that. They go into raw, open cheating. It goes on. What for? So that I get money. What for? So that I can have a gold. I become super rich and I have a gold-plated Mercedes and so on. What is the point of this? Samprapte sanniti kale nahi nahi rakshati dukrim karne, Swami said. And there is a famous Tolstoy story. How much land does a man need?
Yes.
You need 6 feet for you to be buried, that's all. So we have forgotten all these things. And all the pollution that I referred to and you commented upon really starts with pollution of the mind. So when Swami was with us, he dinned one lesson into us again and again. Listen, fellow, you are made up of three entities, the gross, the subtle, and the causal, the source. The gross is your body. Subtle is your mind, effectively. The subtle is your pranashakti to move around and this and that, circulates your blood. But most important is the engine called the mind, which is the CPU of the system. And then above that is the Atman. No, Atman and the CPU brain, not brain, mind, are supposed to be closely connected. In fact, the mind is the son of God, son of the Atman. But if there is parental rift, and son says, Dad, you mind your business, I mind my business, then he becomes vulnerable to pollution or infection. There are only 6 viruses that can infect the mind. No more, no less. And how to fix them is also known for thousands of years. We throw both those pieces of knowledge aside, say, now I own my own. It is like a fellow driving a Lamborghini or Ferrari, which a car which does not have brakes, absolutely no brakes. He drives it over a mountain road and drives fast. What is to happen will happen. Now humanity as a whole is going on that path. So I think your question was, what do we do with it, deal with the problem?
How do we balance both? On one hand, growth, and on the other hand, environmental degradation because of growth.
See, I will say, first you have to make a choice. What is life for? If I say life is a journey towards God, a lot of my necessities will disappear out of the window.
But what do we do with people? Not everyone subscribes to this view that life is meant for us to go back to the source.
See, that will not be understood by all. That was never understood by all. But you created an ambience in which values dominated. See, most people were not told you be good so that you can go back to God. That would have never worked. You created an ambience where the truth was considered as paramount and so on. And this kind of God and goddesses was just a sort of goal towards that. Every religion used it. And Christianity, Jesus likes you to suffer and sacrifice. So you love Jesus, you do it for Jesus. The American Indians, they said, our ancestors lived here. This place is holy land. In fact, there is a famous letter supposed to have been written by Chief Seattle to the president in Washington. They wanted to buy off a lot of land. Incidentally, city of Seattle is named after this chief. This letter was written in 1846 or something like that. And he says, you are going to take away this land from us. Literally by arm twisting. But for heaven's sake, keep this place holy and sacred. Our ancestors drank this water. Our ancestors walked through the forest. Don't cut them. Our ancestors did not destroy the place. They took just what they needed from here to eat and survive. The rest they left alone. This is sacred land, holy land for us. Don't do anything. Those fellows said all, no, we won't do anything, and then did exactly those things. Because for them it was real estate, it was forest, it was money. Everything was money, including water. So there is something beautiful and absolutely divine in these things. We have become so insensitive. So moment I focus on values, my craving for things will decrease. Now most of the time we crave for things we don't want, which we buy with money we don't have, in order to impress others. I heard some time ago on BBC program, they were interviewing a lady in India. She is a sort of upper middle class. She is exporting Indian jewelry and all that. She was complaining there is so much corruption, the rules are so nasty, and if only we had a better government, I would do so. I could export 10 times this, I could become a millionaire and all that. Okay, you become that. What will you do? The interviewer asked. I'll throw away my car and buy a Mercedes. Not Mercedes, Porsche car. How do you drive a Porsche car in crowded Bombay? I don't know. But that's this thing. And then the BBC was very smart. They went out and caught hold of her maidservant. Asked her, what are your dreams? She says, I'm working, my son is working, my daughter is working, we all work in this house. They are not able to go to school, they are not able to study. They will end up doing the same job. Their entire livelihood will be like this, the grandchildren will be like this. I am hoping that if better days come, my children can go to school and live better than me. So it is a completely different yardstick. So some people's ambitions grow so much, they aggrandize and make others subservient to them. So this iniquity settles in. Lord Martin Rees, who is the Astronomer Royal in England, and he gave a series of 5 talks on the BBC. BBC has every year 5 lectures honoring their founder, Lord Rees, way back in 1930s. They are called Rees lectures. They are very prestigious. And in that he says, today we have 7.2 billion people on earth, and we are struggling This earth is capable of maintaining a population of 15 billion, provided you have the standard of living of a man in Central America. He has a very small hut, he has what you call, he consumes very little of electricity and energy, so the earth can take that load. Now the problem is, we have created a system where unless there is growth, there is stagnation. Basically, growth is no longer a vehicle for increasing employment, because everything is done automatically by machines.
Absolutely. Growth so doesn't necessarily...
doesn't translate. It only translates into wealth for a small few. As they say, it is taking the wealth of the many and giving it to a few. So this sharpened pyramid is very much there. Few own most. That's the long and short of it. And I heard the chairman of Goldman Sachs saying in a program presented by Farid Zakaria of CNN, I heard the audio. He says, look, the law is now the winner takes all. You can't change it. Winner will take all. But you know, we have to be compassionate. So what do? Let the church take care of the rest. In other words, a few tycoons, 1% will take care of 60-70% of the wealth, and all the rest have to be taken care of by charitable institutions. Charitable institutions also, at least in America, some people contribute. In India, we have the third largest number of billionaires. That doesn't reflect in the charities. They are newly rich. They say, I must now use this to become more rich, more rich, more rich. So, unless we globally decide we will be bound by certain limited thing, the greed must be exhausted. If greed is put on the throne and said greed is good, then we are in for trouble. And we are in for trouble because most of us are silent, we don't raise our voice. All sorts of people raise their voice for all sorts of things. You try to put some restrictions on the media, they will come out on the streets and throw stones and all that. Nobody is shedding a tear for dharma. That's what Swami said. Have you ever shed one tear for dharma? You cry for your wife, family, daughter, son-in-law and so on. Somehow, dharma is a word that, how many times people use the word dharma in a day, I don't. I think it's interesting to calculate that. Maybe it's become irrelevant. People say it's not possible to dharma. Dharma is not for the Kali.
The difficulty of being good.
Yes. There is a fundamental... And how can you stock all that and live seeing your having large patches of land becoming deserts and forests disappearing by millions of acres?
Absolutely. In fact, another statistic that I came across is a professor at the Indira Gandhi Institute of Developmental Research. She says that production loss because of land degradation in 2010 was 16%, that is 13.4 million tons, which works out to about 162 billion rupees because of land degradation. That is a loss that India suffered in 2010. And of this, essential cereals make up to 66% of this loss. We are losing our soil, we are losing our water.
No, we are losing our soul
losing
more
our soul.
Than anything else. Nobody bothers about it. If you talk about that, they say you're an idiot, you're a fool, you don't understand
the reality. More and more what Mahatma Gandhiji said becomes so relevant. Means this planet, this earth can look after everyone's need, but not everyone's greed.
Not one man's greed.
Not one man's greed.
That is because greed is limitless.
Yes.
See, that is the problem. We are not allowed to talk about this. It is not only that. Okay, you have this growth. You have all this tons of money. You have Jaguar, Porsches, and what have you. What has it done to the quality of human life? People are behaving like animals. There is no respect for each other. Everybody, the women are objectified. Wealth is worshipped. And you don't mind driving on a road in your BMW and riding over six people sleeping on the pavement. Oh, that's just too bad. Couldn't they sleep in their bedroom? That's the question people ask. There is a remarkable discourse that Swami gave in March 1999.
You're referring to the Mumbai discourse.
Exactly. Kopres discourse.
Yes.
Where the elite of Bombay were gathered. I know that football ground from outside, for many, many years I used to go past it. In the Rovers Cup finals would be held there. It's north of Oval Maidan. And the elite all gave, during the reception, Sheriff of Bombay was there, this man, that man. Everybody said, Swami, this place is becoming horrible. We cannot live safely. I cannot go for jogging in the morning because I can be kidnapped. My children can't go to school. They can be kidnapped. All this, that, unsafe, do something for this place, Bombay. So, Baba. Only one man spoke positively. He was a doctor. And he said, you must have a positive view in life. Then that is helpful and all that. All the others were wrapped up in fear of their life. When Swami spoke, I was stunned. It was a most unusual speech where he gave it left and right. Next day, Times of India said, Sai Baba thunders. Literally he did. Yes. He said, all of you people have made so many complaints. But have you found out what is the cause? Have you bothered to see what is the cause? Have you ever looked out of your balcony and looked down? There are all the poor people in tarpaulin tents on the pavement. You have access to water. They have no access to water. Your children go to school. Their children work in your house. And that man drives your car, air-conditioned car, taking your children to school. What are his children going to go up to? They will be working for your children, that's all. And you fall sick, you go to expensive hospital. They don't have anybody to give 1 ounce of medicine, and so on. They don't have toilets, they don't have this. Have you ever thought of that? You never thought of that. Why don't you look after their welfare? If you look after their welfare, all this will disappear. That is a fundamental point. In the old days, somebody or the other played the role of benefactor. In some measure, for example, kings used to build chawal trees. For example, if you go to Benares, you will see a chawal tree built by Mysore Maharaja for people going from Mysore.
Yes.
Similarly, if you go to Rishikesh, Haridwar, there are chawal trees built by that community, this community, and so on. Pilgrims come all over. That was one of the standard things that olden days people do. I have seen as a boy in Madurai, when summer comes, people cooperate to do many things. In Madurai, for example, there's a long street. I think it's called the Town Hall Road. It comes from the station and goes toward the temple. And it's not a very wide road, it's a road. When summer comes, all the shopkeepers will join and build a pandal, coconut leaves interleaved pandal, all the way from station to it's 1 kilometer. They will all contribute and it will be covered. So you don't have to use your umbrella. And also in villages and other places, there will be places where they have mud pots kept in sand which is watered. So that it acts like a fridge. Some people will give you drinking water.
Yes.
And other people will give you dilute buttermilk. In villages. As you go, if you are thirsty, there will be a tumbler, he'll pour it in there, you drink and go. It's very simple things, but these are very essential things. One of the most remarkable things in village roads was, there will be 2 stone pillars like this, at the shoulder height and a crossbar. Have you any idea what that was for? You wouldn't know. I've seen that they will carry burden on their shoulder, and sometimes they will take that burden off and put it at that height.
Oh, okay.
And then take some rest. If you keep it on the ground, you know you have to lift it and put it. So they had it at shoulder height. Oh, and it's so 2 stones like this and another like this.
Into doing something for the other. You felt one with the other.
Yeah, I mean, you care. The poor fellow is carrying the shoulder load. And I've seen it all over South India.
Ahmedabad, if you go to the old city, you have all these huge... they are called these kabutar khanas. They have for very beautiful arrangements for all the birds.
Yeah.
They felt so much for the other beings and not only men, but even other beings.
This rangoli in South India
yes.
was made out of crushed rice.
Rice, yes.
That is to feed the ants.
Ants. Yes.
And they will always feed the cows before the food is eaten. My mother would first offer naivedyam. Then she will make rice balls and go to the courtyard and throw and cry for crows. And the tradition is the ancestors come and eat. In Nasik, when I did my mother's, last rites, first anniversary of last death, there is a place where crows come, just near the river Godavari. Everybody goes and puts pindam there. And the crow is nature's scavenger. Yes. Does the job free. So, you respect the crow. You respect the ant. If you don't tell them on the standard biology, eco-biology, you said, this is important, God comes in this way, feed God,
yes.
So on and so forth. And there was something, they were of course innocent, but there was something very gracious about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, time is running out, so we'll have to close, but one of the important things that you mentioned as you began this talk on the significance of Navaratri is, even as we do all these rituals, we should understand the larger perspective of everything. And I think that is so important for us. And I think that is the only way we can perhaps celebrate the festival in the right spirit. Every ritual, be it the yagyam that we do, everything has so much of significance. Instead of doing it mechanically, we should look at it, the spiritual significance as well as its day-to-day relevance, about how we can really understand its impact to us, to society, to the world, and then do it with full consciousness, with self-awareness. I think that is when probably we will benefit, the world will benefit, and that is when we can preserve these rituals also in their, I would say, in its pristine manner.
Can I add one word?
Sure, sir, please.
This is on the last day of the yagyam here. We celebrate Purnahuti.
Yes.
That Purnahuti is captured by the Brahmarpanam Slokam of Krishna.
Yes.
Because something is offered to the fire. That something is God. The one who offers is God.
Yes.
The fire which receives is God. And in the end, Swami will bless it. See, it goes to God. So every Purnahuti, I used to see the Brahmarpanam Slokam enacted before me. How many people think of that?
Absolutely.
Now, the Brahmarpanam Slokam is the genetic key for creation. Everything is God. Food is God. Food comes from earth, that is God. Food comes because of water, that is God. Food comes by nutrition, which is provided bacteria. Bacteria is God. So if you look at this, you will see a very complex divine cycle in everything that is God. So I am speaking God. I am supposed to be God.
Yes.
The message, hopefully, is divine. The microphone, Swami has said so many times, the microphone is God. The microphone is powered by electricity. Yes. Electricity is God because it comes from somewhere in nature.
I think
you ask people to think about this and write down what are the divine cycles they see in nature. It will be very interesting.
Very interesting. Absolutely. And I think that is the perspective that we should have as we celebrate this Navaratri, to see that consciousness in everything around us. As it is said, consciousness sleeps in minerals, it dreams in plants, and it moves in animals and awakens itself. You know, in man, it is self-conscious, actually.
That comes last. Awakens first at what I call level 1, level 2, level 3. Level 1 is creativity.
Yes.
God is a creator. You see creativity, painting, writing, music, art, and all that. Level 2 is what you may call achievement. Then level 3 is becoming conscious of others, their suffering, and showing divine qualities. When a man is suffering, we appeal to God because He gives compassion. So you show compassion, you are revealing divinity.
Yes.
That is the level 3.
Wow. And I think that is how perhaps we should tune ourselves as we celebrate this Navaratri. Thank you so much, sir, for coming to this Thursday live show and sharing a very, very relevant message as there are a few days left for this wonderful festival, and a festival which is celebrated in such a grand way in Prashanthi Nilayam. And dear listeners, we now move on to our regular segment, Service, Love in Action, which is generally aired at this time. And we once again thank Professor Venkatraman for coming over and sharing his insights on this very relevant season about Navaratri. And so happy listening, and I now we move over now to service, love in action. Thank you so much.